everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. One single issue, in-depth discussion on why we should be paying attention to those things that are relevant. Today, how the cosmological and physical sciences should inform us about our concept of God and its relevance in facing future challenges. My guest, Dr. Nancy Ellen Abrams, a philosopher, historian, attorney who addresses the interconnections between modern cosmology and science and cultural meaning in areas where traditional myth informs science and vice versa. She's a graduate of the University of Chicago in History and Philosophy of Science, received her Doctor of Jurisprudence degree from University of Michigan Law School, and in the past she's worked as an attorney for the International Jurisdictional Association in Rome, a European Environmental Law think tank, and the Ford Foundation, and the U.S. Congress's Office of Technology Assessment. Her husband is Professor Joel Primack. He is a renowned astrophysicist who first co-authored the theory of dark matter and dark energy. In addition to two volumes co-written with her husband on the social relevance behind the cosmological sciences for transforming the world, she is the recent author of A God That Could Be Real, which posits that a revisioning of our God concept in light of the new cosmological and physical sciences can have a major impact upon the future of the planet. Her website is nancyellenabrams.com. Nice to have you with us today, Nancy.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Nancy, we invited you back for a longer conversation as part of the understanding of our civilization today at a critical impasse. And in fact, many of us believe, myself included, that we're reaching dangerous thresholds. We're reaching tipping points. I believe our economy is about to crash and burn because we have nothing backing it up. Nothing. We are 14 to 1 debt to income with our gross domestic product. We're worse than Greece and Spain and Portugal. Yet the world does not cast us into a negative light because we have power. We also are environmentally at a tipping point, multiple tipping points. You have 22 states that are running out of water and some on the East Coast, like Delaware and North Carolina and Georgia. In other places, you got water, but too much. And as a result, you can no longer do sustainable farming because it's rotting the roots. You also have a whole generation of young people, the millennials, who are tipping into despair and apathy because on the one hand, we're told by the official people in Washington, we only have 5.3% unemployment. Anyone who chooses to look will see that there are at least 13 to 16 million people who want to work, who can't find work, and as a result, they're no longer counted. Well, what kind of alchemy of economics is that? As a result, kids who worked hard to get their degrees, who ran up debt with baccalaureate or master's or PhDs, are now unemployed, living at home, and someone is being charged interest on the debt they can't afford. We have the return of debtors' prison. So our society is collapsing in bits and pieces, and we're not paying attention. If you're not a part of that collapse, you deny it or avoid it. So I want us today to bring into context the fact that we live in denial, collective denial, individual denial, group denial, and we're not going to change anything if we consider the consequences of living in that denial. So that's where we begin. Now, the majority of Americans today continue to associate themselves with a traditional religion, although people are leaving the religious institutions in greater droves now. However, more and more people no longer even believe in a God and only believe in scientific truths or kind of libertarian belief centered on ego and self-gratification by any means as long as it keeps a person out of prison. And this aligns so well with what you shared on your noon visit with us. So if we apply our reason and critical thinking skills, begin to understand the universal laws and scientific observations that disciplines such astrocosmology and physics inform us about it, then it should be self-evident that many of our blind conceptions of God don't hold up to scrutiny nor make any sense. Although I'd like us to focus more on the emergence of an authentic postmodern spirituality that is not at odds with either science nor the more valid mystical truths behind major religions, because there is immense spiritual wisdom there as well, please visit the concept of your previous conversation to bring listeners up to date. But first, I want to read a few sentences you wrote and a major question you pose, and then ask you to take it from there and summarize the answer as you will. You wrote, quote, "The question, does God exist, is a hopeless distraction that will never lead anywhere positive. I had to turn the fundamental question on its head. If I wanted to find a God that is real, I had to start from what's real, what actually exists. I realized that the question that matters is this: could anything actually exist in the universe, as science understands it, that is worthy of being called God?" That was profound, what you said. So please answer your own question, and in your answer, please touch upon one of the more pervading, traditional, monolithic myths about God and that you identify, that is, the myth of a God that can disobey the fundamental laws of nature, cosmology, and physics. The form is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. The question, does God exist? The only way that you can ask that question is if the person you're asking the question to knows what you mean by the word God. And the fact of the matter is, people have all kinds of different notions about God. And when they ask you, does God exist, you just don't know if what they're asking about is, well, which God it is, or what kind of concept they're asking about. So it is truly a hopeless, impossible question to answer until the word God can be defined. And as we all know, it can't. It can't unless there's a complete rethinking of it, which is really what I'm trying to do here. What my question was, could anything exist in the scientific universe that is worthy of being called God? Now, that's actually a complicated question, because what does it mean to be worthy of being called God? To me, I have been working a 12-step program for almost 27 years, and I have to say that before I started that, I really was an atheist, not so much because I was opposed to people's ideas of God, but because the subject simply didn't interest me at all. I didn't see the point of even thinking about God. I just didn't see how it could be real or how it could matter to me in my life. And I wasn't an atheist even as a child. So it simply never occurred to me that it would matter until I found myself in a really difficult place in my life. So those people who are listening who know about 12-step programs probably understand that in order to recover from some kind of addiction, the idea is that you can draw on a higher power. And for atheists who come into the program, this is very difficult. We don't even know what that means. But we're encouraged to pretend. We're encouraged to act as if we have a higher power. So that forces us to think, well, what would it be if I did have one? What does it mean? Now, it took me many, many years to think through this, but I really did pretty much dedicate myself to trying to figure it out. And I realized gradually that the challenge of any 12-step program, and possibly the challenge of any religious, well, any for any seeker, is to find a concept of God that helps us do what we cannot do alone, what we have never been able to do by ourselves. It has to be a concept that works for us. You can't just buy into somebody else's idea of God and expect that to really make any difference in your life. it's a real challenge to find a view of God that works for you, because your traditional one probably doesn't if you're in any kind of a 12-step program at all. So that was my motivation. Now, you mentioned that my husband is a very well-known astrophysicist and is one of the inventors of the modern theory of the origin and of structure in the universe. That is, let me just tell you, the question that he was trying to solve was, if the Big Bang was symmetrical in all directions, why isn't the universe today just a bigger soup of particles? Why are there galaxies that are beautiful spirals and ellipticals? Why are these galaxies structured along long filaments? They're laid out on filaments as if someone had sprinkled glue, had laid out lines of glue and then sprinkled glitter over them. That's how the galaxies are laid out. And where the filaments intersect, there are giant clusters of galaxies. All this structure has formed since the Big Bang, but why? And it turns out that the answer is that most of what's going on in the universe is completely invisible, that what we see is less than half of 1%. That is, all the galaxies, all the stars, planets, gas clouds that are glowing, everything that can be seen in all wavelengths of light is only 0.5% of what's actually out there. There are these two enormous dynamic presences, shall I call them, called dark matter and dark energy, and the way that they are interacting with the visible matter in the background, in the black background of the universe, has spun the galaxies into being and created the only possible homes for the evolution of stars and planets and life. So this is an enormous theory. It completely changes our view not only of how the universe works, but where it came from, how it began. Now, I was living through the development of this theory for the same approximately 30 years that I was trying to work this 12-step program. So naturally, the two of them melded in my mind, and I was looking for a God that is real, because frankly, if God isn't real, I don't see what the point is of talking about it. So I was interested in a God that was real, because I felt only a real one could really help me. But it had to be real for me, not in a common sense way, but real in this double dark universe, the double dark meaning dark energy and dark matter, real in the universe as we understand it now. So it occurred to me after many years of actually playing with this idea that what I really need to do is to say, if I want a God that's real, I have to look for it in what's real. I have to look for it in the universe as we understand it. Could there be a God there? And if so, could there be something there that is worthy of my calling it God or higher power or something that would help me? And that was really the beginning of this big idea that came to me, which is based on another scientific idea. The idea is called emergence. Now, I realize that emergence is not familiar to many of your listeners, so let me just give a couple of really simple examples of it, and then I will show how this applies to God. So, for example, the room that you're in is full of air molecules, and the air molecules are just banging into each other, and they're zooming around the room in quite a chaotic manner. And yet, out of all the chaos of those zillions of air molecules, there emerges a number, and that number is the temperature of the room. Temperature is what's called an emergent phenomenon. No molecule has a temperature. And yet, if many of them are interacting in a very complex way, a temperature emerges. It never existed before. Emergence happens in life also. If you have a few ants crawling around, ants are very, very simple creatures. They can't think very much. All they can do is follow scent trails, and they have a sort of a sense of number. They can tell the difference between running into say, 2 ants in a minute and 200 ants. They can tell the difference between those two things. But they can't do much more. And yet, when tens of thousands of them are together in a colony, a swarm logic emerges. And the colony has very sophisticated abilities that no ant has. It can build an anthill, for example, the size of a man. It can apportion, it can send out a certain number of ants to forage and a certain number of ants for childcare and a certain number of ants to be soldiers against competing anthills. And it can keep track of where the food sources are. Who's doing this? There's not a single ant that understands any of it. And yet, the system is self-organizing. It emerges from the complexity of these interactions between the animals. Now, emergence happens everywhere. We ourselves, we human beings, are emergent phenomena. What's going on inside us is that there are trillions of microbes, independent microbes, basically, inside us that do all the work. They digest our food. They produce our energy. And yet, out of this incredibly complicated community inside us, 90% of our cells are not human cells. They're these microbes. Out of this very complicated community, we arise. We, human beings with a mind and a consciousness and a sense of who we are, and we outlast all of them, just like the ant hill outlasts the life of any of the individual ants. We, humans, outlast all of our cells. Our cells die and new ones come back. And this is the nature of emergent phenomena. They emerge without the intention of the individual parts, and they outlast the individual parts. Now, this principle is what gave me my big idea. And that's this, that the only thing that could be absolutely real in this universe, but would be worthy of the name God, is an emergent phenomenon from us humans. Now, we're the ants in this metaphor. And what has emerged from us has emerged from the complex interactions of all of our aspirations. And I do make the argument that aspirations are absolutely real, because, frankly, a person with no aspirations is nothing but meat with habits. Everybody has aspirations. Everybody listening to this right now has aspirations. And so we really can't say that other people don't. We know that we all do. It is the defining characteristic of humanity that we are the species that aspires. And we have grown and evolved far beyond what the external conditions require of us. We've taken over the planet. Why is it our species and not any of the other species? This is why. Because we aspire to have more, to be safer, to be loved, to understand. We just keep aspiring till the moment we die. And all of those interactions between all of those aspirations must create an emergent phenomenon. Now, the question is that emergent phenomenon God? You don't have to call it God. And, you know, if you're allergic to the word God, you don't want probably to call it God. But you have to recognize that it exists. And this thing that exists, this amazing thing that has arisen from all of the aspirations of generations and generations of human beings, is powerful. It sets the reality that we live in. It's the, well, you might call it the meaning sphere that we live in. I mean, that's a sort of a metaphor of atmosphere, but it's a kind of a meaning sphere. It has set up our whole picture of reality. So I think that that, for me, is God. And the more I think about it, the deeper the connection becomes and becomes very fertile. You mentioned that I said that the old versions of God can't exist. And that's absolutely right. We have been taught in our lives very grandiose notions of God that don't make any sense in the universe as we understand it now. For example, God, we are taught, created the universe. Well, God could not have created the universe, not the God that I'm talking about, but not any God, because what we now understand is where the universe came from. We don't understand the very, very beginning, because there is no such thing. I mean, people always want to know what came before that, what came before that. And that, in fact, is how science works. We start from today, we move backwards and learn more and more. So for a few decades, the Big Bang was considered the beginning of the universe. And then another theory was put forth called cosmic inflation that explains what set up the initial conditions for the Big Bang. It explains the moment before the Big Bang. And this is not just an unsupported theory. It makes five specific predictions. Four of them have been tested, and all four of those have agreed with the theory. So there's still that fifth one to be sure that that agrees, and that hasn't been tested yet. But we have to take this theory very seriously. So now you might ask, well, what came before cosmic inflation? And what the theory says, if you extrapolate backwards, and now here I'm going into metaphysics because we don't know how to test this part of the theory, is that there was a state of being called eternal inflation. And that is a state of being where everything is expanding so fast, so much faster than the speed of light, that nothing can ever form, not even an atom. And so what our universe is, and possibly many other universes are bubbles that form in this weird state of eternal inflation. Okay, we don't know if eternal inflation is true, but it is our best theory right now. And if it's true, then to say that God created our universe, you'd have to put God before eternal inflation. What does that even mean to say something existed before eternity? It's not even a meaningful phrase. And there really couldn't have been anything before the universe that was complicated enough to plan a universe, because everything we know about our universe tells us that complex things evolve from simpler things. So something as complex as God couldn't have existed before the universe. And, you know, there are other very clearly scientific reasons why God also can't possess all knowledge, because that's also not a meaningful thing in a relativistic universe. There is no set of knowledge that can be possessed by anybody. And God can't violate the laws of nature if it's real, because nothing real can violate the laws of nature. What's real is real because it's an expression of the laws of nature. So after I eliminated the things that were impossible about God, what I wanted to know was, what's left? What's left? And what I found is left is this emergent God, or emerging is really a better way of putting it, because it's constantly emerging from our continuing aspirations.
Okay, let's just stop for a moment. You've given us some challenging thoughts. I'm going to go to the end conclusion of something I've been thinking for a long time, and that is, why not take all the religions of the world and have humanistic, compassionate people within that given field who are expert in it draw from the text and the sacred scripts only that which honors love, and exclude everything that honors death, destruction, rape, pillage, incest, and all the other things that you will find in the Old Testament. So I think you would have to look at any book that was written all by men and no women, where women are historically there to serve, and the misogyny of that, the politics of those people during different periods of life, and the fact that some of these sections were written over hundreds of years by many different people, and then it was politically selected which books would be put together, and just start from scratch and say, here is the abbreviated edition of living a moral and ethical life. If the purpose of religion is to honor a God, and if the purpose of God is to inspire us to a higher ideal, then how in the world could you have anyone believing that you're living in God's image if God is a rapist, God is a misogynist, God is a murderer, God is an enslaver? You couldn't, unless you were, quite frankly, mentally unstable. And yet most, not all religions, follow that complete logic, which to me is just insane. So that's one thing I'd like to put out there, that why don't we just have something new that only honors that which is honoring life, that we can prove moral equivalency. Do good. Don't steal. Don't commit war. Don't commit crimes. Work together. Cooperate. Heal one another. And yet,
well, let me tell you something.
Would you address that?
It would be lovely to have a book like that, but it would not be enough. It would not be enough. We, for example, are in this situation where our world is addicted to infinite growth on a finite planet. You even alluded to this earlier on in the program. This is a moral issue, but it has no answer in any traditional morality. And even love will not solve this problem. The problem is that ever since around the year 1800, we humans have been increasing the amount of resources we have taken out of the planet. We have been doubling them every 30 years. This is especially true of fossil fuels. Every 30 years, the amount has doubled. And we are now on a path to, as you mentioned before, total destruction. We don't know. This cannot go on. At the same time, the population has also been exploding, and not just the population, but the expectations of each of those people in the exploding population has also been increasing exponentially. We have all these exponential trends that are multiplied times each other, which means that they're getting worse far faster than they would even alone. Now, how would a book that tells us to only love each other answer how are we going to get out of this trend? How are we going to do this? It's not enough. We know we need to love each other. We do. But we need to understand our time and our place. What we really need is a big picture that explains the world we actually live in, the state of our species at this moment of history, and science. It has to be based on science, because science actually is the only thing that's equally true for everybody around the world. It's the one real common ground that we have.
Okay,
it's true, there are people who deny it, but that doesn't make it less true for them.
Nancy, I agree with you, but I also agree there must be a marriage between real independent science and humanistic spiritual values. Because in real independent science, you look at the world and say, we cannot continue exploiting the environment or exploiting labor or exploiting people, taking their lands, as hedge funds are doing now in Africa with Bono and some of these other, you know, media dilettantes who clearly are not thinking of the consequences of what they give their celebrity status to. We have a society that is out of control. We're spinning out of control. Once enough people hit critical mass of greed, then they collectively, there's a synergy of common energy. It's palpable. They get richer, they get more powerful. They don't want to surrender the power or the riches, the fame or the access to more power and more fame, more riches, because that's all they can identify with. And as a result, more of those people try to get into that circle, creating a greater intensity to where they control all of our body politic. They elect the politicians. They select them, then we elect them. They control the media. Seven outlets own 1,700 media vehicles. They control the natural resources. 147 companies control 40% of the world's wealth. And yet the average person would never know who any of these people are who run these companies. And you ask, if you already have $1 billion or $10 billion or $50 billion, why do you need more? And the answer is, you don't. You'd want to use that money to help a larger cause, to get off this cycle, unless you yourself are coming from an imbalanced emotional place without spiritual consequence. You're out of the light. And as a result, we have Just the opposite. The people who should never be elected or given power over us are the people we elect or give power. From the cops that are killing kids, to the people who are militarizing everything, to the laws that take away our rights and make those of us who speak out domestic terrorists in their eyes, to the private prison system, to reintroducing out of the 1800s the workshops in the United States, because you have workshops, because you have prison labor and the privatization. None of this could happen if you didn't have wealthy, powerful people who were misaligned, who were have maladapted their energies to the nothing is finite as long as I can continue to exploit it and profit from it. Now, that's what I see.
But true.
I'm going to add one more thing in, and then I'm going to let you address this. I believe that much of the religious violence today is associated with the transcendent attribute of God, a God that is infinitely distant, utterly unknowable, completely unchanging, and still capable of acting like a puppeteer who can manipulate everything on the planet and universe, even reserving the Big Bang, reversing it if he desired. I find this particularly galling, these attributes of a God, to be very disturbing, and has contributed to untold suffering and misery throughout history. I think ISIS, or even fundamentalist Christianity and Judaism, is to bear the blame. If the extreme militant Christian right controlled the country right now, the United States, I have no doubt that we would have a theocracy and penal laws and penalties not very different than ISIS or Saudi Arabia. Do you see any relationship between the idea of a transcendent God, which is not present in the world, with violent actions and a blind belief that such violent actions will not be held accountable because believers are conducting what they believe to be servitude to a transcendent being?
Yes, here's the problem. When people lived in small tribes and they had no contact outside those tribes or groups, it was very easy to say that my God is the only God and it runs everything. But now we are living in a world that is completely connected, fully wired pretty much, and everybody's gods are conflicting with everybody else's. The problem is that no God can be universal. The very idea of a God being universal is absurd. I mean, there are people who even believe that the God that they worship controls aliens that might live on other planets. Somebody interviewed me not too long ago, and they wanted to say, well, the Ten Commandments must be universal. And I said, well, you know, what about the one about adultery? We don't know how aliens reproduce. And the guy was just totally blindsided. He had no idea how. No, these people don't think. You can't have one group with the universal truth. It's not possible. So, yes, it does cause violence, because with each group thinking that their sense of morality was given by a universal God, naturally they then have to think that it's true, and if you go against it, you're going against the God of the universe. But people have different notions of what their moralities are, and they all think they're given by this universal God. So, of course, that leads to violence. But let me just step back a little bit from what you said before, because you did go through quite a litany of terrible things that are happening in the world. But you know what? There's never been a time in my life when you couldn't list a bunch of terrible things happening in the world. And I remember when I was a child and we had to hide under our desks for air raid drills because the Russians were going to drop nuclear bombs on us. We had a terribly scary time then, too. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. There have been terrible things going on at all periods in history, if that's what you focus on. I think that the only way to really change these terrible trends that you were mentioning is for people to find a vision that they can come together around. And we don't have that right now. Having a local God, that is, having a God you think is universal, but it really just belongs to your group, is giving us tiny identities. Small identities hold us back. I mean, people today define their identity in small ways. Their tribe might be, for example, their business or their profession. They identify by that, or their religion, or they identify by their political entity or by some ideology, maybe an ethnic group. Maybe they identify with an age cohort, or as you mentioned, they identify with a certain wealth status and don't want anything to do with people who don't fit in there. But in any of those cases, these people are framing who they are, inside that context. They simply don't understand people outside that. And they're not able to see that there are big truths that are facing all of us. And let me just step out a little further. You, of course, have heard the concept of the chosen people. But who are the chosen people, truly? We who are alive today are the chosen people. We have been chosen not by any merit of our own. We have been chosen by chance to be on the planet at this pivotal moment in history. And I think it's pivotal not just because of the specific things that are going wrong here and there, but because this is the end. This must be the end of the 200 years of inflationary growth. We have to move to a sustainable world. And sustainability is not something that people can enforce on others. It has to become a value, a sacred value. What I am trying to do more than anything else is to make it possible to have one big picture. It doesn't describe everything that's going on in life. It doesn't tell us how to live. It doesn't threaten the diversity of our lives. That's not what I mean. A big picture is a picture on the big scale. It tells us where we come from, how we got here. It explains the 14 billion years of the evolution of our universe and the 3 or 4 billion years of the evolution of life on this planet. We share that with every other human. We share it with every animal. We have to see ourselves as part of an ongoing process of life that really must be preserved. And I think that when we have a picture of God that fits into this, and an emerging God does fit into this, it is completely coherent with science and with our understanding of history. It gives us a much bigger view, and we can start to have a big picture.
Okay, well, Nancy, I don't believe that you have to have the association with God to have the bigger picture. I believe that there are energies. In fact, I was the first scientist in the United States at the Institute of Applied Biology to actually prove this when I had a group of individuals, 50 to start, and only 6 were able to complete it, where they were able to cure rat after rat with ascites tumors by just doing meditations with them. Now, since they were not susceptible to human personality and any form of charismatic exchange, but when this happened, in fact, one of the people in that experiment was Dr. Dolores Krieger, who was head of nursing at NYU. And from that, therapeutic touch in nursing, an accredited course now, evolved. Well, when you're looking at what caused the healing, they all had different religious views. There was a rabbi from Brooklyn, a rabbi Abraham Wiseman. There was Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of St. Luke. There was a chiropractor who was an atheist, Morty Jacobs. So it wasn't any one defining religion or anyone believing that they were being, a vehicle through a God presence, but they all believed in energy. So we know that the only thing that's missing when you're dead is energy. We know the only thing that defines life is the message coded in the energy. When you're
born.
But
now you're talking on the physical level, and I'm talking on the psychological level. I'm talking about a vision. I'm talking about how do we end. How do we escape this terrible inequality that you talked about? How do we escape the despair and the apathy that you talked about? That's what I'm talking about.
We can have faith.
People have to come together.
Okay, but Nancy,
is what requires the vision.
Okay, all right. Let me share my thought, and then please respond.
Sure.
I believe that there are enough people today who have found that believing in nothing is not in any way enhancing their quality of life. And yet some people have that belief. They don't believe in anything. these are not just people who carry around this existential view or agnostic view. These are people who truly are disconnected. That does not mean they're unethical. It does mean they're immoral. Then there are other people who believe that they don't have to believe in a God, but they believe that there is a energy that is transcendent, that there's something that continues on. And in that energy, this, you could call it a spiritual energy, it has the capacity and power to move people, to cure people. I've seen this. As a scientist, I've seen it. I've seen how it works. Now, so I believe that we have to look at that and ask ourselves, have we too narrowly defined a God presence? Should we not look at other options to define some of the miracles that have happened in life, some of the unique experiences people have one to another, or creatures to, you know, your dog, your cat, your bird, to you? And I believe that we have not looked broad enough and deeply enough. I think we keep trying to come back to this God thing, and it doesn't work for everyone. And one other thing I want to ask you is, a fundamental religious practice is prayer. Atheists, of course, are prone to make fun of prayer. How can people possibly pray to a God who often doesn't display any real signs of caring about the well-being of its followers? The global South remains extremely religious and devout, especially Africa, where poverty and disease and malnutrition and massacres and genocides are constantly present. Yet religious faith increases. And I find that kind of religion best defined on the order of the victim-perpetrator bond in psychology, which results in a relationship that can be defined as terror. So do you feel people can pray to this new God concept that you're discussing?
I feel that people can pray, but not to God. This is the kind of God that I'm proposing is not a personality. It's an emergent phenomenon. And an emergent phenomenon is radically different from its constituents. It's not something that we can actually understand what it is, any more than an ant can understand its whole anthill and how the anthill is functioning. What I'm offering here is an origin story for God. I am offering a way of understanding how something God-like can have come into existence and can be something that we are all plugged into at every moment of our lives, that feeds us, that we alter with every one of our own aspirations and actions. That's what I'm saying. I'm explaining this can really exist, but I'm not telling you what it is, what it's like, because it's God, because it's going to be beyond anybody's understanding. And the more you aspire to understand it, the more you expand it so that it's always beyond you. So the kind of God I'm talking about can't discriminate between people any more than gravity discriminates between people. But nevertheless, there are dancers and there are acrobats who can play with gravity in beautiful ways. And then there are klutzes who can't walk through a room without knocking something over. But the difference between them is not gravity. Gravity isn't making them behave differently. It's what they do with gravity. It's how they train themselves. It's how aware they let themselves become. And that's really more the way I think about the emerging God.
Okay, I appreciate those
insights.
Now,
let me just say, you did want to talk about prayer. One of the most important things I think we can do is to bring our consciousness into the real universe, the kind of universe that allows a God to emerge, our universe. And everything we learn about our universe and meditation on what it feels like to be part of the double dark universe is a prayer. To me, that is prayer, because it's bringing us into contact with the consciousness, the level of consciousness where God can exist.
Okay, then address this. First, every religion and traditional spirituality posits the existence of a spiritual world. So how does science inform us the presence of such a world? And then second, death and the afterlife are essential and centric in every religion, ancient or modern, East or West, monotheistic or polytheistic. Contemplating death is an extremely powerful force. So how might the question of death and the presence of an afterlife be understood in a science-friendly spirituality?
Okay. Well, let me talk first about the idea of the spiritual world. What we know about this universe is that there is no way that we can contact anything outside our universe. So the very idea that God is somehow outside our universe and basically in a spiritual realm that is not constrained by the laws of physics, that idea is utterly meaningless. If there's anything out there, it's not our God, because it'll have nothing ever to do with us. So that idea of a spiritual world doesn't make any sense. But our universe is structured in such a way that we are only conscious of a very small part of it. If you think about our universe as a range of all possible sizes, and you take the smallest size as being the Planck length, which is really a size that's simply dictated by physics as the smallest possible size, and the largest size being the size of the visible universe. There may be stuff beyond that, but since we can't say anything meaningful about it, we'll take that as the largest size. And you take that as the range of possible sizes. You have a range of about 10 to the 60. Okay, so that's a 1 with 60 zeros after it, centimeters. We are only conscious of a very small part of that range, say from the size of the tiniest little creature that can be seen, maybe a gnat, up to about the size of the sun. But all of the things that exist in this universe outside those size ranges, the galaxies, the galaxy clusters, the super clusters of galaxies, which are these immense sheets of 10,000 or so galaxies, these things we can only know about through science. And the same on the small end, the particles, most of DNA, and everything below the size that's visible, these things we can only know about through science. Also, we have instruments that we've invented that we can see a little bit of, but it takes a tremendous amount of theory and interpretation to understand what we're looking at. So outside that middle range that people have always had some sort of intuition about, the whole rest of the universe is essentially spiritual in the sense that we can only know it through science, and we can only have contact with it spiritually through meditation, through learning. So the spiritual world exists, but it's most of the physical universe.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I would posit it differently. I believe that everything in life starts off spiritual and does not have to, we do not need science to give us a meaning to life or to understand life. Life was not meant to be figured out. It was meant to be lived. It is our quality of maladaptation from those who are in our life that frequently takes us away from that which is spiritual. There was a man who died of a heart attack. He was dead for over 56 minutes. He got to the hospital, or on the way to the hospital, he resuscitated. And it surprised everyone. So some doctors did some studies on him, knowing that that kind of long deprivation of oxygen and blood to the brain would have caused permanent brain damage. And there's a DNA marker when you cease all life. And he had none of that registered in his body. And that meant that some power, other than that which could be defined by science, was involved in allowing this man to resuscitate. We have all seen in all cultures, the Native American cultures, I've seen people in the Amazon, shamans, do things that science cannot explain. They may try, but that's just their narcissism, that they need to try to find a scientific explanation for all things in life, and it doesn't exist. You cannot scientifically define intuition. You cannot. I think it is the height of arrogance when we say that science must be the final arbiter of life. I believe that a spiritual understanding and acknowledgement of the quality of life is more than adequate, and I've seen too much in my life as a scientist, but also as a humanist. I've seen miracle cures. I've seen things happen in a medicine. They say, oh, it was a spontaneous remission. Okay, fair enough. Then, doctor, show me an example where you've had a spontaneous remission. Show me any. Well, we haven't. In this whole hospital, Sloan Kettering, show me one that's ever happened where an end-stage person that you're putting in hospice care within a short period of time reverses all the cancer in their bone, in their brain, in their liver, in their breast, and without any therapy. Show me that case. What doesn't? But over here, if someone else shows you a case where it's reversed with nothing in a short period of time, you say it's a spontaneous remission, but you have nothing in science or medicine that you can use. This is the foolishness of, in my opinion, of trying to make everything a model of science. I'll give you the final word on this. We have 2 minutes.
Well, perhaps I was unclear. I certainly never said that science is the final arbiter of anything. In my opinion, science is the first word. We need to build on it, but everything that we build on it is based on ourselves as human beings, on our needs, on our amazing abilities. And certainly in biology, as you were just explaining, there have been miraculous cures because people don't really understand how the human being works. Of course, these amazing things have happened. But that's not to say that science is irrelevant. It's just that there is no explanation for it. Do you still want me to say something about the afterlife? Because I would like to say
the one thing
that we know for sure that happens after we die is that we become ancestors. And in many cultures, ancestors are revered. But in our culture, they're not. In fact, even our old people who are still alive are not revered. I think this is a terrible mistake. I think we really need to understand that our ancestors are not just our grandparents and our great-grandparents. Our ancestors go all the way back through all the primates, through the development of our planet, through the dark matter and the dark energy, all the way back to the beginning of the universe. That is our story, and every stage of that is an ancestor of ours. If we want to be ancestors that are honored 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now, how do we do that? We have to act like honored ancestors. We have to do what honored ancestors would do, and I think that before every law is passed, on every budgetary decision, the real question should be, what would esteemed ancestors be doing now? Because that forces us to take a very, very long-term view of the future.
I agree.
Like the long-term view that we now have of the past. What? And when we see ourselves as ancestors, when we see ourselves as part of this immense flow of life, Then we have the big point of view that can let us, I think, see solutions to global problems that we cannot see when we're in our small minds.
But there are a lot of people today. Nancy, there's a lot of people around today who have no background in science, but a tremendously deep background in spirituality and life issues. And when you look at what science has become today, the science of let's say, the spying technologies, the war technologies, the pharmaceutical technologies, you think, what would have happened had those same scientists or the companies they work with had some spiritual, moral, ethical, humanistic values instead of ones purely based upon greed? A different world.
You are so right on that, and that is exactly what I'm trying to do. I am trying to pull together the moral and the spiritual with the scientific. I am trying to put, this is what I mean by a big picture, a coherent big picture, because if we had this, then we would not only be sharing things that are known to be true all around, but we would be able to share this sense of connection that we have to each other, to everybody on the planet, to every species, to our ancestors, to our descendants, all of that.
Nancy, we're out of time, but let us remember, there are native cultures throughout the world that never had a scientist speak with them, and they lived in perfect spiritual harmony with nature, with each other, and the species for a long time. So I don't believe that we need to marry spirituality and science. I believe we have to marry spirituality and humanistic concepts of sustainability. Thank you very much, Nancy Ellen Abrams. I appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you.
And that is our Progressive Commentary Hour. Her book is A God That Could Be Real. Her website is nancyellenabrams.com. Have a nice day, everyone.